He never ate before a game and was always starving afterward. It was not inconceivable that he and Betsy and Mark might stop somewhere for a hamburger and time would slip by. It would be Betsy's curfew. Jeff would have to take her home, and then there would be just himself and Mark. Jeff was the one who owned the car, and if he was worn out from the game... "They wouldn't do that," David said again, but his uncertainty showed in his voice. "At least, I don't think they would." "We can't take that chance," Susan said. "We've got to go up there right now." "Up to the mountains? Are you kidding? Just you and me? Without Mark? We can untie him and bring him down as well as they can. It's gone too far, Dave. It isn't fun anymore. When you told me about it at first at the picnic, I thought it would be fun, but it isn't. It's awful." She was crying now. In the faint light from the street lamp at the corner, David could see the glitter of her tears sliding out from under the rim of her glasses and making shiny streaks down the sides of her face. The sight upset him more than he would have expected. "Well," he said, "hell, I guess we could. It's just that Mark would be so pissed off. When he plans something, he likes it to go his way. Why should what Mark wants matter so much? We're in this just as much as he is, aren't we? Why shouldn't what we want matter?" "You don't understand," David told her. "Mark isn't like other people. He struggled to find the words he wanted and was unable to do so. Mark was Mark. It was that simple. You didn't try to explain Mark. You just accepted him."
"But Mark's not here now, and we are. Please, David, we've got to go up there. We can't leave him a minute longer."
Her words came out in a strangled sob, and David felt his heart twist suddenly within him.
"Okay," he said gruffly. "Okay, you win. Just stop the sniffling, will you?"
He threw the car into gear and stepped on the accelerator. They didn't talk much during the drive to the mountains. David, whose experience in night driving was almost non-existent, kept his eyes focused on the limited strip of road that lay exposed in the path of the headlights. He was acutely conscious of the girl on the seat beside him. She was sitting very straight and still, with her hands gripped together in her lap. Her head was bent, and her hair fell forward, so that when he glanced sideways, he could not see her face. At one point, he asked, "Are you still crying?"
"No, not anymore."
"Do you want to move over this way?" Wordlessly, she loosened her seatbelt and slid over on the seat so that she was close beside him, her shoulder touching his. She reached up and took off her glasses and wiped the lenses on the front of her blouse.
"I didn't mean to make such a fuss," she said in a small voice. "It's just the thought of him up there, alone."
"I know. It's okay." To his surprise, he found he really meant it. At the moment, he felt calmer, better, happier than he had for a long time. The car interior was a world in itself. He and this girl, whom he had hardly known before the past week, were its only inhabitants. Outside the car windows, darkness poured past them and drew together behind them, blocking out further reality. With his hands upon the steering wheel and the gas pedal under his foot, David knew a strange, exhilarating sense of freedom. His mother, his grandmother, school, sinks full of dishes, bowls of lime-colored gelatin were left far behind him. What would it be like, he wondered, to keep on driving, to never come back? What if he didn't turn north onto the road into the mountains, but stayed instead on the highway, following it as far as it went, all the way to the coast? He tried to imagine what it would be like there, the air moist and salty, waves pounding upon sparkling beaches, gulls circling and screaming overhead.
"Did you ever see the ocean?" he asked Susan.
"Yes," she said, surprised at the question. "2 summers ago, my folks took us to California."
"Was it nice?"
"We had a pretty good time. The beaches were fun. Then Kevin, my little brother, cut his foot on some barnacles and had to go to the emergency room for stitches. Things like that always happen on our vacations."
"I've never been to either coast," David said. "I was just thinking what it would be like if we kept on driving until we reached the water."
"Then we could take a ship," Susan said. and go on farther and find an uninhabited island. People back here would think we'd disappeared off the face of the earth. You think about things like that, too? Someday I'm going to live completely alone in a cabin a million miles from anywhere and think and read and write poetry and maybe even novels. She paused and then asked tentatively, Do you think that's crazy, wanting to do that?
That's not crazy, David said. My father... He stopped himself.
Yes?
He did something like that, I think. Just left and went and did his thing without worrying about what people thought. He looked like me. My Gram says he did anyway, and there's a picture of him I found, and I remember a little. I remember his hands. They were thin and strong, and they were always gentle when they touched me.
Did you ever notice Griffin's hands?
No, Susan said.
Not really. Should I have?
I guess there's no reason you would. I never noticed them myself until this afternoon when we were tying him up, and all of a sudden I got this funny feeling. There was something about his hands that reminded me of my father.
How odd, Susan said.
Shouldn't the turnoff be right along here someplace?
I think so. It's hard to tell at night.
David squinted into the darkness.
Is that it, that road there?
That is a road, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's it.
Let's try it, Susan said. If we're wrong, it just means backing out and starting over.
David turned the car onto the dirt trail and inched it forward, the headlights throwing back strange shapes and shadows as trees and bushes and rocks emerged from the depths of the darkness and crept past them and fell away again as new forms took their places.
It's the right road, he said.
How can you tell?
I remember how it took a jog to the right. You can't see it now, but there's a big, craggy sort of rock there on the left.
I can't see anything, Susan told him. Just what's directly ahead of us.
Sometime later, she asked.
Haven't we come too far?
No way. We go to the end, remember?
But it's taking so long.
That's because I'm driving so slowly.
All we need is to get stuck here. That would really fix things.
They drove on in silence, and then, suddenly, they were at the clearing. Susan caught her breath with a little gasp.
Someone's here.
No, that's Griffin's car.
You left it parked right here where anybody could see it?
Who's going to see it? Nobody comes up this far, especially at night.
He pulled up next to the Chevrolet and turned off the ignition and the headlights. Immediately, they were overwhelmed by silence. Complete. Unbroken. Heavy. Weighted. The absolute stillness of a forest at night. For a long moment they sat, unmoving. When Susan spoke at last, it was in a whisper.
It's so black.
There's a flashlight in the glove compartment. My mom keeps it there in case of emergencies.
David reached across her and groped along the dashboard. He located the button and pressed it, and the front of the glove compartment swung down and he reached inside. For one awful moment, he thought the light was not there, but then he found it, shoved back under some papers. He took it out and pushed the door back into place.
Okay, he said. Are you ready?
Without waiting for her answer, he pulled the handle and opened the car door. He got out, and his feet crunched loudly into dried leaves and dead branches.
Wait, Susan said. I'll come out your side.
And she slid out behind him.
For some inexplicable reason, David could not bring himself to slam the car door. The sound would have cut through the stillness like a gunshot. Instead, he let it ease into place, and then he pressed the switch to turn on the flashlight. The thin beam shot ahead of them, illuminating the path entrance.
Okay?
He asked.
Okay,
Susan said shakily, and then,
Dave, think how dark, how terribly dark it must be back where he is. Think how it must be for him lying there. All alone, not knowing if anybody's going to come, ever.
Well, we're here now, so he doesn't have to lie there much longer, David said reassuringly.
He took her hand. It felt small and cold in his, and he squeezed it hard.
There was no reason for a girl like Susan to be here, frightened and remorseful, staggering around the mountain darkness. Why had he drawn her into this crazy plot, he asked himself angrily. Why, indeed, had he been drawn into it himself? It had been a dumb idea right from the beginning. People didn't go around kidnapping other people just because they didn't like them. There was nothing amusing about it, nothing to be gained by doing it. If anyone but Mark had suggested it, he would have told him he was nuts. But somehow with Mark, things always seemed so sensible. When Mark looked at you with those odd gray eyes of his, when Mark spoke your name and put his hand on your shoulder, how long has it been since you did something crazy, just for the hell of it? Mark had asked him. And it had been as though he had reached straight into him and placed a finger on the open sore at the core of his soul. After that, things had happened so fast, there had been no time for reconsidering it. It had all been there before them, laid out the way it should go. He had been swept up by the plan as completely as though it had been his own. He had thought of calling Susan. Or had he? Was it he or someone else who had suggested that? He had hardly known Susan at that point. To him, she had been no more than a studious, shy little mouse of a girl who had tried to help him catch his papers when the wind had caught them.
"Well, let's go," he said. "The sooner we get there, the sooner it's done. He's going to be one mad dude when we get to him."
The beam of the flashlight led them forward, and a moment later the bushes had closed in behind them. A few paces more, and they could hear the waterfall. It grew louder and louder, much louder than it had seemed in the daytime, as though the whole night was made up of rushing water. As they approached the stream bank, David tightened his grip on Susan's hand.
"There's no way we're going to get him out of here without untying him," he told her.
"You do know that, don't you? If Jeff were here, he could do it. He'd just drag him out with the ropes and blindfold still on him, but I'm not a jock. We'll have to untie him here and let him walk out."
"I know.
What I mean is, he'll see who we are. There's no way to prevent it. We're really letting ourselves in for it. He can have us expelled."
"I know," Susan said again. "It doesn't matter. I mean, of course it matters, but we don't have any choice, do we?"
"I guess not," David said. The light moved ahead and fell upon him. The man by the stream. He was lying exactly as he had been when they left him, straight and still, the blindfold neatly in place. A cry broke from Susan's lips, and she dropped David's hand and hurried forward.
"Oh," she moaned, dropping to her knees beside the still figure. "Oh, Mr. Griffin, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry, so sorry."
Her voice broke, and she grasped the rope at the man's wrists, fumbling for the knot.
"David, I can't find the end. How did you tie this? Oh, please, hurry and get this off him. It's cutting off his circulation."
"Here, it goes all the way around behind." David knelt down beside her. "I'm sorry, too, sir. This was a dumb, rotten thing to do. We'll have you undone in a minute. Try to roll over sideways so I can reach the knot and back." The man did not move.
"He's asleep," Susan said in amazement. "How could he be asleep with the ground so hard? Mr. Griffin, wake up. Please, wake up. We're here to take you home."
"Move back, Sue," David said hoarsely.
"But we've got to wake him."
"I said move back. Let me get at the blindfold." He gripped the cloth with numb fingers and yanked it upward until it slid off the forehead and onto the ground. Then he lifted the flashlight and turned the beam straight into the man's face.
"His eyes are open," Susan breathed. "He's not asleep. His eyes are open."
"He's not asleep," David agreed softly.
"Then why doesn't he move? Why doesn't he say something? Mr. Griffin, it's Sue. Susan McConnell? From your lit class, remember? Please, Mr. Griffin!"
David turned the light away from the wide, unblinking stare of the man on the ground beside him. "He's not asleep," he said. "He's dead." Chapter 9.
"We've got to get to Mark."
The single sentence screamed again and again through his brain.
"We've got to get to Mark. Mark will know what to do."
It got him back down the path, dragging Susan behind him, stumbling,
falling once, getting up again, Susan's wrist still tightly encircled by his hand. It got him into the car, the key into the ignition, the engine into life. It took them back along the dirt road without running off the side into the underbrush, back onto the highway without swerving and running headlong into an oncoming car. "We've got to get to Mark. He will know what to do." Dave said it aloud, emphasizing each word. "To do? How can anybody do anything?" Susan said. "You can't make a dead person come alive." She wasn't crying. Susan, whose tears had fallen continuously since the middle of the afternoon, was no longer weeping. David glanced sideways at her there on the seat beside him, dry-eyed and expressionless, her lips pressed tightly together except when they parted to let the thin, flat voice come through. "There's nothing Mark can do," Susan said. "We're murderers." "We didn't kill him. We hardly touched him. I swear it, Sue. Nobody roughed the guy up. He was fine when we left him. You know what he said to us? Mark told him, 'Beg us, Mr. G, plead with us.' And he said, 'I most certainly will not.' Does that sound like a guy who's been banged around? People don't just die for no reason. This guy did. I swear it, honestly, we didn't hurt him. The worst we did was tie the rope around him. That could never kill anybody." David bore down on the accelerator. "We've got to get to Mark. He'll know how to handle things, who to call, what to do. What the hell do you do when somebody's dead like that, for no reason, way out in the mountains? Who goes and gets them? An ambulance couldn't ever make it up that road." "We can go to my house and get my dad," Susan said. "He'll help us." "Mark first. We can't do anything until we tell Mark. My God, Sue, why did we have to be the ones to find him? If you hadn't insisted we go up there, it would have been Mark and Jeff. They'd have taken care of things. It was crazy for us to have gone up there without telling them or anything." They pulled into the Del Norte parking lot. It was seething with activity. Voices shouted. Headlights blinked on in all directions. Car horns blasted as automobiles tried to inch their way into the creeping lines of traffic. "The game must just be over," Susan said. "You'll never find him in this." "Sure I will. We're in luck. There are parking spaces." There was one right ahead of him, and David pulled into it, braking and shifting suddenly so as to bypass the fender of the car next to him. "Come on, let's get in there." "I'm not going." "What do you mean you're not going?" "I just can't face it, all those people yelling and screaming because we won or lost a basketball game. David, what's wrong with you? We don't belong here. We ought to be..." "Okay, okay." He didn't want to listen to her any longer. "I'm going to find Mark. This is your last chance to come with me. Are you coming?" "I want my dad." "We'll talk about that later. We tell Mark first. Are you coming?"
"No."
"Then sit here and wait. I'll be back in a minute. We'll be back in a minute." He left the car and half walked, half ran across the parking lot. People were pouring out of the doorways to the gym. He had to stand on the edge of the flood, working his way in between two outward-rushing people, then between another pair. Somebody shouted, "Hey, Dave, where are you going?" Somebody else gave him a hard shove in the ribs with an elbow, muttering, "The tide goes in the other direction, dude." Mark. Where was Mark? David worked his way down an aisle. The crowd was thinning now, and there was nobody left on the gym floor. The score was still posted on the board, home team 61, visitors 57. Del Norte had won then, as usual. There was no way anybody defeated Jeff when he charged down the court, a head taller than anyone else, that ball under absolute control. Why couldn't the rest of life be controlled so easily? How could things get out of hand so quickly? Mark! Mark, where are you? Then he saw him at last, down at the end of the court in front of the door to the locker room, standing with Betsy. Dave broke into a run, his eyes trained on them, unable to see anything except the two figures. Mark! He opened his mouth to shout the name, but no sound emerged. Mark! 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 His lips kept moving, but nothing came from between them. They saw him now. Both of them had turned toward him, Betsy with her lips parted, her eyes wide and astonished. "Why, it's David!" Mark's face was inscrutable. "Yeah, it's David. How goes it? Something the matter?" "He's dead," David said.
He had not meant to state it so abruptly. The words flew out of him, escaping from his throat and over the top of his tongue before he could stop them, before he could weigh what he was saying.
He's dead.
There was a moment's silence. Then Mark said, Griffin?
Yes.
How do you know?
Sue and I went up there. We looked at him.
There's no guessing about it, Mark. He's gone. He's
gone.
How could one describe those eyes staring upward into the far-reaching, incredible space of the night sky?
He's dead, Mark.
I believe you.
Betsy was staring at both of them, speechless.
Where's Sue?
Mark asked.
Why isn't she with you?
She's out in the car.
In the lot, here?
Yes.
Then get out of here, man. She might take off across the place and yell to a cop. Run, now. I mean it.
Aren't you coming?
Sure, I'm coming. I've got to wait for Jeff. Betsy, you go with Dave. Do something about Sue. You know how she'll go. A total basket case.
He reached out suddenly and touched Betsy's cheek, his hand light, almost but not quite a caress.
Hey, girl. I'm counting on you.
Yes.
Okay.
Betsy's eyes were huge in her round face.
David said, I mean, it's not true, is it? It can't be, can it? Mark, he's not really... I mean...
Get going, will you? Nobody needs to see us standing together like this. Jeff will be out in a minute and we'll come join you.
They went. They crossed the corner of the gym floor together, David's hand placed protectively beneath Betsy's elbow. A few people turned back, smiled at each other. Guess what? A new romance. The senior class president and the head cheerleader. What a perfect combination. Why hadn't it happened sooner?
You didn't mean it, did you, David? It's all a joke, isn't it?
A real funny one,
David said numbly. He tightened his grip on her elbow until his nails bit into her flesh and she jerked away from him.
Where am I? He asked himself in bewilderment. What am I doing here? Where has the night gone? It's a dream, that's all. One of those crazy dreams that seem so real, and yet you know all the time down underneath that in a minute you'll wake up. A moment ago it was 6 o'clock. We were eating dinner, Mom and Graham and I, and then I went out, and I stopped at Susan's, and then...
They reached the door to the outside. Now they were through it, walking together across the parking lot.
Where was the car?
Over there,
David said.
That's it, over there.
It was the only car parked alone and unmoving amid the turmoil of flaring lights and sounding horns. Sue was still in it. He could see her profile outlined against the lights of the cars beyond. Her head was turned at a right angle with her eyes focused on the gym doors. Her chin was high. She was still not crying. Even before entering the car, he could tell that by the lift of her chin. They reached the car and opened the door and climbed in. Susan turned, her glance going past David, past Betsy.
Where's Mark?
Coming. He had to wait for Jeff.
You said you'd get him. Did you tell him?
Yes. He'll be along in a minute.
Are you okay, Sue?
Betsy asked.
You're not going to go to pieces or anything, are you? You look like you're okay.
Here they come, David said with relief.
That's Jeff, see, over there against the lights?
Mark must have dragged him out before he hit the showers.
Did you tell him?
Susan asked again.
I said I did, didn't I? Her calm was frightening to him because it was so unnatural.
He reached out for her and could not find her hand. He wished suddenly that he could throw himself across the seat that lay between them and put his arms around her and hold her and tell her to go ahead and cry and cry. Cry for herself and for him, too, for Mr. Griffin, alone on the bank of the mountain stream, for all of them. Jeff and Mark were closer now, a tall figure and a shorter one, working their way across the lot. Eventually they reached the car and Mark opened the front door on the far side.
Shove over, he said. Move over, Sue, I'm getting in beside you. Dave, you get this thing going. Jeff, get in back with Betsy.
Where do you want to go?
David asked.
Anywhere, Mark said. Give me a minute and I'll think of a place. Meanwhile, just drive. Get us out of here.
David started the engine and drove out of the lot and turned east on Montgomery. After they had gone a few miles, Mark said, Pull in here.
It was a lot behind a row of apartment buildings, and David steered the car carefully into it and drew to a stop behind a garbage bin. He turned off the key, and there was silence. For a moment, no one spoke. Then Mark drew a long breath.
Well, he said, it looks like your dream came true, Jeff, old boy. We killed Mr. Griffin for real.
We didn't, Jeff said. We didn't do anything to him. Nobody's going to stick this on me. I hardly touched him.
Nobody can stick it on any of us, Mark said. We've got our alibis. Dave was with his grandmother all afternoon watching television. You and I were at Betsy's.
We've got that solid, Betsy said. The woman next door phoned Mom tonight while we were eating dinner and complained about how we played the surround sound so loud we woke her kid up from his nap.
And tonight most of us were at the game. People saw us there. The best thing now is to show up at the burger shack as usual and then head for home.
You mean not tell anybody? Susan said in amazement.
Why should we do that?
Why? Because there's a man dead.
Would he be any less dead if we told people?
No, of course not. But you can't just have somebody die and not report it.
If we reported it, we'd have to tell about the kidnapping, Jeff said. Who'd believe us when we explained how we were just having a little fun? They'd check over his body, and there'd be bruises on him where he fell down, and maybe the ropes have made cuts on his arms and legs. Whatever happened to make him die, that would be blamed on us, too, even though we didn't have a thing to do with it. We could end up in jail.
We're minors, Betsy reminded him. Minors can't be jailed, can they? Besides, my dad's on the county commission.
Hold it, Bets, Mark said. We wouldn't be considered minors now.
What do you mean? Betsy asked in bewilderment. We're all underage.
If somebody's killed during the commission of a felony, it's first-degree murder, Mark said. Kidnapping's a felony. No matter what our age is, we'd be tried as adults.
But that's not fair, exclaimed Betsy. Besides, it wasn't a real kidnapping. It was a joke.
Who's going to believe that? Jeff asked. We could spend the rest of our lives in jail.
And talking about your dad, think what this would do to him. It would be all over the papers. County commissioner's daughter indicted for murder. Christ. And my mother.
David felt a wave of nausea hit his stomach.
There's no way I could tell my mother. We have to tell, Susan insisted. We don't have a choice. People will be looking for him. Mrs. Griffin will call the police, and Mr. Griffin won't show up to teach tomorrow, and everybody will know he's missing.
Lots of people turn up missing, Mark said. It happens every day. Right, Dave?
David nodded. They do. Men leave home. They go, just light out and go, and years go by, and nobody ever finds out where they went. Their wives go on all right. It's tough, maybe, but they make out.
His own mother's face rose up before him, the lines etched deep around the corners of the eyes and mouth. A saint, the Reverend Chandler had called her. She had liked that. Not every woman had the chance to become a saint. It was rough, of course, but was it really any worse than being a widow? We're clean as soon as we get rid of two things, Mark said. The body and the car. Once those are gone, there's nothing left to worry about. We can't do anything tonight. It's too dark and too late. And we can't cut school tomorrow. It'll have to be tomorrow afternoon. Who can get hold of a shovel?
I can, Jeff said. We've got one in the garage.
What about an extra license plate?
Silence followed the question. Then Jeff said,
Maybe Tony. No way, Mark said firmly. We're not letting anybody else in on this. There are too many of us involved already. If we take the north road down from the mountains, we can come into town on Coors Road. That should be pretty safe if we time it to hit the evening traffic. All those people who work in the factories come home that way. We'll be part of the swarm.
And then what? Betsy asked. Once we get the car back to town, what do we do with it?
We can park it at the airport. That lot's always full, and cars get left there for months at a time. When they do find it, if they do, it will look like Griffin took a plane someplace.
And the body?
David forced out the question. You're planning for us to bury it? That's simple enough. Right where it is now is a perfect place. Nobody ever goes there, and the dirt will be soft because of the stream.
No!
The word burst from Susan's lips like a cry of pain.
We can't do that. Just take Mr. Griffin and stick him in the ground. We can't pretend it never happened, that we're not responsible. We killed him, all five of us. Somehow we killed him. I don't know how, but if we hadn't done what we did, he would still be alive this minute.
You can't know that, Mark said reasonably.
I do know it. People don't just fall down dead for no reason.
And they don't just fall down dead from being tied up for a few hours.
I don't care what you say. We've got to tell somebody. My father...
Sue. Sue. Simmer down, baby. Mark's voice was suddenly gentle. I know how you feel. You and Dave were the ones who found him. That was rough. And that's over now. You don't have to go up there again. The rest of us will take care of everything. It's going to be all right, baby, I promise.
It can't be all right, Susan cried miserably. Mr. Griffin is dead.
Did you stop to think he might be dead regardless? Mark placed his hand under her chin, turning her face to his. Look, sweetie, we didn't do the guy in, and you know it. Dolly Luna got kidnapped by her students last semester, right? She didn't fall dead on them. It's a sick person who dies like that without a reason. It could have happened anywhere, in his home, behind his desk at school, walking down the street. When your body quits on you, that's it. Wouldn't it have been worse if he had been behind the wheel of his car and plowed straight into a bunch of kids waiting for the school bus?
If he had been at home, his wife could have called a doctor,
Susan said. My own dad was at home when he died, Mark said softly. It would have been better if he hadn't been. He was in his bed asleep, and the house burned down.
Oh, Mark! She regarded him with horror. How awful!
Damn right, it was awful. The point is, when it's your time to go, you go. You can't keep saying, if this and if that. It doesn't change anything. You can't go back and change anything. You've just got to keep on living. Wrecking our own lives wouldn't bring Mr. G back, now would it? It wouldn't help at all. It would just destroy us and the people who love us.
My parents couldn't bear it, Susan said. Nothing like this ever happens to people like my parents. They're so nice and normal. They just think about things like cooking and property taxes.
They don't have to know. Nobody does. It's all right, Sue. He put his arm around her shoulders and pulled her over against him. It's all right, Sue. Susie. It's all right, baby. Just trust me, okay? It's all going to be all right.
The tears came at last, with the suddenness of a dam bursting, one gigantic sob that seemed to shake the car, and then the wild, heavy weeping. Mark's other arm came around her, and he held her through the storm, his face still and impassive, the heavy-lidded eyes half-closed, staring out through the front car window into the darkness beyond. He held her that way for a long time. When the weeping slowed, he turned to David.
Does your mom keep tissues in the glove compartment?
David opened the compartment and found no tissues, but there were some paper napkins. He extracted one and handed it to Susan, who took off her glasses and wiped her eyes and blew her nose.
Let's head for the diner, Mark said to David. We'll hang around there just long enough to have a soda, so people will see us. Then we'll go home.
Chapter 10.
Is he gone already?
Irv Kinney asked. His wife, Jean, glanced up from her coffee.
Jeff came by for him earlier than usual this morning. He was honking the car horn out there at 7:30, and Mark was out the door before I could even ask him if he'll be here for dinner.
Why should he be here for dinner?
Irv asked her, getting a bowl out of the cabinet and opening the top of the new box of breakfast cereal.
Sometimes I wonder if the kid lives here at all. Days go by, and I never see him. He sleeps in till his friend blows the horn for him in the mornings, and he doesn't come home at night till after we're in bed.
Where does he eat, anyway?
I think he picks up hamburgers, Jean said. You know how kids are.
I know how our kids were, and it wasn't like that. We had our ups and downs with them, sure, but they sat down at the dinner table with us like they belonged to the family, and we saw enough of them evenings and weekends to remember what they looked like from one month to the next. Mark's been living with us 4 years now, and I swear I don't think we've ever had a conversation.
Our kids were real outgoing. Everybody's not the same.
That's for sure.
Irv carried the cereal bowl over to the table and sat down with it. He reached for the milk carton.
Sometimes I wonder if we did the right thing, taking him in like that. We raised our family once, and starting all over again at our ages, what made us think we could do it?
We didn't have much choice, did we, with your brother Pete dead and Eva with a nervous breakdown? Mark was only 13. He's your nephew. Who else would have taken him?
Well, that's it, of course. There wasn't anybody but us. I kept thinking Eva would come around after the shock was over. Still, if we'd said no, the courts would have had to come up with something for him, a foster home, maybe, with people there who were used to handling weird kids.
Mark's not weird, Jean said. You keep comparing him to our kids, and you just can't do that and be fair about it. He's gone through things they never had to go through. Imagine seeing his own house burn down with his father inside it, and then having his mother crack up and turn on him like that and say she never wanted to see him again? Why, that's enough to make any boy different.
Weird, different, what does it matter what word you use? What it boils down to is that the kid gives me the creeps. I say that even if he is my brother's boy.
I've tried to reach him, Jean. You know that. You remember how I stuck up for him after he got in that trouble at school?
I went in with him and stood behind him and tried to get them to give him another chance in another English class.
He appreciated that, Irv.
Did he? I never could tell.
Why did he do that anyway, crib on that paper? He's smart enough. He didn't need to do that. Maybe his girlfriend put him up to it. She was older than he was. Young boys can be influenced a lot by girls like that.
Where does he go nights? That's what I want to know. You ask him, and he says, nowhere much.
Now, what kind of answer is that, nowhere much?
Last night I heard the front door open and close around 11:30. That's the earliest he's come in all month.
You don't think he's into drugs or something, do you, Jean? I don't know any better than you do, his wife said. If he is, there's nothing we can do about it, so what's the sense agonizing? He's almost 18. He'll be graduating in another month or so. There'll be enough left from his father's insurance so he can make out until he gets his feet on the ground. You and I will always know we did the right thing.
I guess you're right, Irv said with a sigh. I just have this feeling.
He let the sentence fall away, incomplete.
I wonder if he'll keep in touch with us after he leaves.
Probably not, Jean said, taking a sip of coffee. You're not eating much this morning, David's mother commented at breakfast. Are you upset about something, David? You and your friend didn't get in a fight last night, did you?
No, David said. We met up with some friends and went out with them for food around 11. My stomach's still full from that.
You were out awfully late for a school night, his mother said. I hope this isn't going to become a regular thing. You know I need my sleep, and there's no way I'm going to get it if I'm worrying about you out driving around till all hours.
I'm sorry. It won't happen again.
To please her, he picked up a slice of toast and took a bite out of it. The bread was hard and dry and crumbly, and the butter felt slimy on his tongue. He was afraid he couldn't swallow it. He picked up his glass of milk and took a gulp, willing the mouthful down.
I can't believe it. Our little Davy dating.
His grandmother regarded him fondly from her place at the end of the kitchen table, her gray hair still uncombed, her flowered robe hanging open to reveal the pink cotton nightgown her daughter-in-law had given her for Christmas.
Young people grow up so fast these days. Why, on that game show with the newlyweds, you'd swear there wasn't one of them any older than 16.
I'm 17, David reminded her automatically.
Yes, I know, dear. You told me that yesterday, or was it yesterday? One does lose track of time when one gets old. Yesterday was the day you went out with that boy with the funny eyes, and rode around with him and his friends, and never came home till dinner.
It was not. David set his glass down so hard that the milk splashed over onto the tabletop. I came straight home from school yesterday. I got you Jell-O, and you and I sat all afternoon and watched television. You do remember that, don't you, Graham? That was yesterday.
It was?
The old woman reached up a wrinkled hand to shove a strand of hair back from her forehead.
I get confused. One day gets to be the same size as the next when you're my age.
You're not that old. You can remember. David's voice rose sharply. Yesterday was Thursday, right? It was Wednesday I went out with Mark and the other kids for a while. Yesterday, Thursday, I came right home from school and got you the green Jell-O I'd made that morning for you when you ate it, and I turned the television on, and we sat there together all afternoon long. I was right in the room with you all afternoon.
David, for goodness sake, his mother said. You don't have to shout at Graham that way.
I want her to remember.
I remember, I remember.
Old Mrs. Ruggles nodded agreeably.
I remember the green Jell-O, after all those weeks with the orange stuff. Where's the rest of it, Davy? I want some for breakfast.
There isn't any more, David said. You finished it.
A whole package? She couldn't have, his mother exclaimed.
That makes four bowls.
Well, I ate some of them.
You didn't,
his grandmother contradicted.
I do remember now. You didn't eat any of it. I asked you if you were going to eat something, and you said no, you weren't hungry. Maybe you dumped the rest of the Jell-O out because it tasted funny.
Why would it taste funny? David's mother asked. Jell-O is Jell-O. It's all the same. That's the same powder in every box. It tasted great, David said. That's why I ate all the rest of it. I just got started, and I couldn't stop, and I ate it all. And I washed out the bowls and dried them and put them away. Is that a crime, being hungry after school?
You didn't eat them, his grandmother said stubbornly. I would have seen you do it.
You were asleep. You fell asleep almost as soon as I turned the TV on. Admit it now. You don't remember anything at all about the shows. Now, do you? What were the questions they asked the newlyweds? Can you tell me?
Well, they asked about...
The old woman closed her eyes and wrinkled her forehead.
Goodness, I don't recall at all. Did I really sleep? I never sleep in the daytime. But you're right. I ate that Jell-O and I just went right to sleep like Snow White did when the queen gave her the poison apple. You didn't give me a poison Jell-O, did you, Davy?
She opened her eyes and laughed delightedly at her witticism. I told you, I ate all the rest of it. If there had been something in the Jell-O, I'd have gone to sleep too, wouldn't I? He seemed suddenly to have no control over his voice. It was rising higher and higher. His mother was staring at him in bewilderment.
Please, dear, don't yell. I've never seen you act like this, David.
Graham was joking about the Jell-O, of course. And there's nothing wrong with catching a little nap in the afternoons, Mother Ruggles. I'd do it myself if I were home and able to.
But I missed my shows, Irma Ruggles said mournfully. I like that girl with the curly hair who won 2 days ago. I wanted to see her win again. Did she, Davy?
Yes, David said desperately. Yes, she won. They gave her an electric mixer.
Only a mixer? The third time winning, they usually give them something really big, like a new refrigerator.
They offered her one, but she said she didn't want it. She already had a refrigerator. She wanted a mixer.
But if she'd taken the refrigerator, she could have sold it and bought the mixer and had money left over. They ought to think of things like that, those young people, but they're just not very sensible. It takes an older head to figure things out.
She paused and then asked,
Is there another package of that Jell-O you could make up for me?
There certainly is, David's mother said. I bought some yesterday. David will make it before he leaves for school, won't you, dear? And it will be all ready by this afternoon.
Sure, Graham,
David said, weak with relief at the turn the conversation had taken. I'll be glad to.
That will be nice, dear.
His grandmother smiled at him benignly.
And this time, Davy,
Be very careful what you put in it, won't you? That last stuff was awfully bitter.
I want to talk to Detective James Bacca.
Can you tell me what the problem is, ma'am? The young man at the front desk asked pleasantly.
My husband's missing, Kathy Griffin told him. I phoned here last night and talked to somebody, I'm not sure who, and he said to come in this morning and ask for Detective Bacca.
Your name, please?
Catherine Griffin.
One moment, please. The young man picked up his phone, dialed an extension, and spoke quietly into the receiver. Then he replaced it on the hook.
Go on down the hall, ma'am, room 107.
Thank you.
Clutching her purse tightly against the front of her maternity blouse, Kathy walked down the hall, counting doorways, 103, 105, 107. The door stood partially open, and she gave it a push and stepped inside. The man, seated in a captain's chair behind the large, paper-covered desk, was stocky and broad-shouldered, his black hair streaked with gray. He did not rise when she came in, but glanced up, nodded, and gestured toward a chair beside his desk.
Sit down, Mrs. Griffin. I got the message about your call last night. Your husband still hasn't turned up?
No, Kathy said, sinking into the chair, her hands tightening convulsively around the purse. There hasn't been a word. I'm about out of my mind.
How long has he been missing?
He didn't come home from work yesterday, Kathy told him. I called the principal last night. Brian's a teacher at Del Norte, and he said Brian was there for all his classes. It's as though in the few miles between the school and our house, he vanished into thin air.
Okay. Let's get some basic information down, and then we can see where to go from there.
The detective drew out a pad of letter-sized forms and picked up a pen.
Your husband's full name and address?
Brian Joseph Griffin, 1020 Ashwood, Northeast.
His age and place of birth?
Brian's 41. He was born here in Albuquerque.
Would you describe him for me, please?
He's, oh, about 5'10 or so, I guess. He's slender. His hair's dark, almost black, and he wears it short. He has blue eyes and wears glasses. He has a mustache.
Do you know his social security number?
No, not offhand. Is that important?
Not necessarily, but it helps because it's an identifying number. It might be the same as his service number. Was he in the service?
No, Kathy said. He has a heart problem that kept him out.
What sort of problem?
Angina. It's a circulatory thing. Sometimes the muscles around the heart clutch up and not enough oxygen gets through. It's painful, but it's controllable, not like a real heart attack. All he has to do is take a pill.
Does your husband get these attacks often?
Usually they come when he's tense and under pressure. He can feel one coming on, and if he takes a pill immediately, he can prevent it. But it was enough of a problem to keep him out of the service.
Where did Brian go to college, Mrs. Griffin?
Stanford University.
Does he have any scars or marks, any tattoos, that sort of thing?
No, Kathy said.
And he's been missing since yesterday afternoon, is that correct?
Yes, he was supposed to have a conference after school with one of his pupils. Susan McConnell, I think her name is. That would have made him a little later than usual. And then, oh, I forgot this. He was going to stop at Skaggs Pharmacy to pick up a prescription for his nitroglycerin pills. I don't know if he ever did that. All I know is he didn't come home.
Has he ever done anything like this before? Detective Bacca asked her. Gone away for a period of time without telling you?
Never. Brian's always called me if he was going to be even a little late.
Has he been worried about anything lately? Has he seemed preoccupied with his work or anything else?
No more than usual. Brian's very serious about his teaching, and he worries a lot over lesson plans and grading assignments, but no. Actually, I think he's been more lighthearted than usual. He's excited about the baby.
Is this your first child? Detective Bacca asked her.
Yes, it is. We got married later than lots of people, and then Brian wanted to wait to start a family until he knew his teaching was going to work out. He used to be a college professor, and he switched over into high school teaching, and he wanted to be sure he could handle it. Her voice broke. Brian's always so precise about everything. I can't believe he would do this. Something terrible must have happened to him.
There may be a perfectly logical answer, the detective said. Let me ask you a couple more questions. Is there anyone, a close relative or friend, whom your husband might contact if he should be in any kind of difficulty?
I can't think who, Kathy said.
His parents are dead, and he doesn't have brothers or sisters. Brian is a very self-contained man. Since he stopped teaching at the university, he's more or less lost touch with people there. You know how the college social structure goes. It's awfully groupy.
You don't do any socializing together?
Oh, we sometimes have my old friends from work over with their husbands, or maybe some of the neighborhood couples, but it's very casual, just playing cards once in a while or something like that. And they're more my friends than Brian's. The most important people in Brian's life, besides me, are his students.
Detective Backus set down his pen and leaned back in his chair.
That's it for formal questions. Now, tell me, where do you think your husband might be, Mrs. Griffin? Do you have any ideas?
Kathy shook her head miserably.
I've racked my brain trying to come up with a logical explanation. The first thing I did, of course, was phone the hospitals in case there had been an accident, but nobody of Brian's description had been brought in.
Does Brian drink?
Never. In fact, he's allergic to alcohol.
Does he have any enemies? Has he ever been involved in anything unlawful?
No, no.
How are things between the two of you? Becca asked her. It's not unusual for a first pregnancy to cause waves in a marriage. It means a whole new way of living. The honeymoon's over, the escape hatch is no longer open, even a crack. Some pretty good men have been known to go into panic during that period of life. And your husband has gone 41 years before being hit with fatherhood.
You're implying Brian may just have run away? Kathy shook her head violently. That's impossible.
I don't mean to offend you, the man across from her said quietly. It's just that we've had three husbands reported missing in the past month, and in every case, the wife's been pregnant. One man got as far as his mother's place in Arizona, had second thoughts, and turned around and came back. The second guy is still gone, but his wife got a postcard from him from California. He wants her to file for divorce. But they'd had a number of problems with their marriage to start with.
It does happen, Mrs. Griffin. Not with Brian.
One final question. What was the last thing your husband said to you before he left for work yesterday? Do you remember?
He said, I love you.
There was a note of hard pride in Kathy's voice.
Brian did not run out on me, Mr. Backa. He's not that sort of person. It just is not possible.
Then there has to be another answer, the big man said gently. People don't disappear into thin air, as you put it. Your husband is somewhere, and we'll do everything we can to locate him. To start things off, I'd like to talk with that student at the high school, the one who may have been the last person to see him yesterday.
Chapter 11
Susan McConnell, come to the office, please.
The loudspeaker in the ceiling over the door blared the words throughout the room, and Susan, sitting hunched over her history notebook, felt her heart drop into her stomach with a sickening thud. It was the moment she had been anticipating ever since she had arrived at school that morning to see Dolly Luna, bright-faced and cheerful, perched on the corner of Mr. Griffin's desk.
Mr. Griffin isn't here this morning, she had explained, so I'm subbing for him. I haven't been able to find his notes for today's class, so we'll just have to play it by ear, I guess. You'll have to tell me where you are in the book, and maybe we can read aloud or something.
She had smiled brightly.
My name's Miss Luna, but if you promise not to tell anybody, I'll let you call me Dolly.
And so they had read, or rather Dolly had read, her lilting voice carrying Ophelia gaily through her tunnels of madness to her ultimate watery end. And Susan had thought,
this can't be real. It's a cartoon, a dream, a nightmare. That's it. It's a nightmare. Soon I will wake up and I'll be at home in my bed with one of the twins banging at the door to tell me I've overslept. And I'll open my eyes and the sun will be pouring through the window onto the rug and outside in the elm tree birds will be singing.
But she had already awakened to that scene an hour before, and one could not wake up twice.
Actually, she could not believe that she had slept at all. When she had gone to bed the night before, she had thought, "I will never sleep." And then exhaustion had rolled upon her in a gigantic, smothering wave, and she had sunk gratefully beneath it. A moment later, it seemed, Alex had been at the door calling in to her, "Sue, are you alive in there? Mom wants to know if you're feeling good enough to go to school this morning." "Yes, I am. I'll be right down," Susan had mumbled, opening her eyes to the sunlight and the bird song and the terrible realization that tomorrow had arrived. She had gotten up and gone into the bathroom and washed her face, pressing the cold washcloth for long moments against her swollen eyelids and puffy cheeks. "I must have cried in my sleep," she thought. "I must have cried all night." When she entered the kitchen, the whole family was at the breakfast table. Her mother glanced up worriedly. "Your cold must be worse, Sue. You look just awful. Are you sure you want to go to school?" "I feel fine," Susan told her. "You don't miss school just for a little cold."
"I would," Kevin said. "I'd miss school for anything. Huh, Alex?"
"Me too," Alex said. "Even for nothing, I'd miss school."
"Well, your sister isn't like you two," Mr. McConnell said approvingly. "She takes her education seriously. If you boys would straighten up and follow her example, we'd have a happier household around here at grading time."
"Sue's a girl," Craig said. "Most girls are boring. Guys are different. They've got other things on their minds." "My guess would be that David Ruggles makes good grades," Mrs. McConnell said. "You don't get to be president of the senior class on D's and F's, right, Sue?"
"Yes," Susan said. "David does well in school."
It was a strange situation finding herself on top for a change, being held up to the boys as an example to follow. Normally, she would have been delighted. Today, she felt ashamed and sickened.
"If they knew, if they had any idea what sort of person I really am," she thought miserably, "they would never, any of them, want anything to do with me again."
She would have given anything at that moment to have said, "You're right, I am too sick to go to school," and left the table and gone upstairs and crawled back into bed with her face buried in the pillow and the covers pulled up over her head, blocking out the world. But the last thing Mark had said to them was, "You guys show up for school tomorrow. We don't want to draw attention to ourselves by being absent. The whole bunch of us are going to be in Griffin's class, just like it was any old day, and we'll be as surprised as the rest of them when he doesn't show. Get me?" And when Mark told you something, you did it. She could understand now what David had meant when he had told her, "Mark isn't like other people." There was a strength in Mark, an ability to know exactly what to do in any emergency, and when Mark said something, you had to believe it, because if you couldn't believe in Mark, you couldn't believe in anything. "Trust me. Trust old Mark," he had told her last night, his arms a comforting fortress around her. "Everything's going to be all right." Mark knew. He had to know. If they did exactly what he told them, things would somehow work out, and the terrible present would one day lie behind them and be the past. And people could forget the past if they tried to. But it was important, terribly important, to do precisely as Mark said. And so she ate what she could of breakfast and collected her books and left for school with the boys, parting with them at the corner to continue down Montgomery to Del Norte, while the twins turned off toward the grammar school and Craig toward the middle school.
"Hope you feel better, sis,"
Craig said, surprisingly, as they split forces, giving her a look of actual concern, and she had murmured,
"Thanks, I'm sure I will."
But she had not been prepared for the appearance of Dolly Luna on Mr. Griffin's desktop. He would have hated it, she thought, just hated it to hear her hacking up Hamlet. She had sat with her head bowed over her book, almost ready to believe that the door might fly open and Mr. Griffin come striding in to take his rightful place and send Dolly flying off to the teacher's lounge for her morning coffee.
"We cannot get away with it," she told herself. "No matter what Mark says, somehow we'll be found out. Any minute now, a policeman will appear at the door, or the speaker will call our names."
Which was why she was not surprised when she heard it at last in history class.
"Susan McConnell, come to the office, please."
Susan raised her head. Two dozen pairs of eyes turned to stare at her.
Mr. Stanton, the history teacher, nodded his permission. In case you're not back before the end of the period, the assignment is to read the next chapter and answer the questions at the end. Wordlessly, Susan got to her feet, collecting her history book, her notebook, a ballpoint pen, her purse.
Will they let me go to my locker for my jacket? She wondered.
It hardly mattered. The cold gripping her came from within, and no layer of outer clothing would ever alleviate it. She crossed the room and went through the door out into the hallway. Mark was leaning against the wall by the water fountain.
What are you doing here? Susan asked him.
Waiting for you.
Did they call you too? Susan asked him.
Nope.
Any of the others?
No. You're the chosen one.
Then how did you know?
I sit by the window facing the parking lot, Mark said. I've been keeping my eye out for a squad car. I was pretty sure when they got the report Mr. G was missing, they'd send somebody over here to check things out. This is the last place he was seen, and you're the last person to see him, so it stands to reason they're going to want to ask you some questions. I've got a biology lab this period, so I slid out of the room and came down to see how you were holding up.
I'm scared, Susan said. I don't know what to tell them.
If they found out everything, they haven't found out anything, Mark said. Not one thing, and don't you forget it. All they know is that Mr. G didn't go home last night and didn't come to work this morning. That's it. That's all. Nothing else. The only way they're going to find out anything else is if you tell them.
They'll ask me questions,
and you'll give them answers. You've got nothing to hide, right? So tell them the truth. You wanted a conference with Mr. G to talk about your grade on that last test. You met him when school let out. You talked about what? Whatever it was, tell them. There's no reason to hide anything there.
He said I was bright enough but sloppy, that I messed myself up by not paying attention to details. He said that in his class an A meant perfect, and that nobody in that class, including me, was doing perfect work, but that I was probably capable of it if I made the effort.
Okay, what else?
He said that I was spoiled, that we were all spoiled, because we're used to overgrading. That so few high school students take their work seriously that anybody who seems to be doing anything stands out. Then teachers reward them with A's even though they don't deserve them, because they're better than the others. And because they get A's, they think they're doing great, and they never even try to push themselves into doing the best work they can possibly do.
That sounds like him, the bastard. F's for everybody, so they'll try harder. Anything else?
Not really. We talked about the test, where I had made mistakes and stuff like that, and some about Shakespeare, what he meant by certain lines that I hadn't understood. When it was over and we started to leave, he started talking about Hamlet's feeling of guilt over Ophelia's death and whether or not that really changed him as a person. That's why I had to walk out to the parking lot with him. I hadn't meant to, but I just couldn't say see ya and walk away from him when he was in the middle of a sentence, and he seemed to take it for granted that I was going out that way.
So you walked him out to the lot, and then?
He asked if he could give me a ride home.
No, he didn't.
He didn't?
Susan asked blankly.
Nope. He had other plans, and taking you home would have interfered with them. In fact, all the while you were having your conference, he acted sort of peculiar. He kept checking his watch and glancing out the window. Sometimes you'd ask him a question and he'd act like he didn't hear it. His mind was on something else.
But that's not true, Susan said.
Sure it's true. How else would a guy act who had a lady friend on his mind?
I don't understand.
When you walked out to the parking lot with the guy, you started off in the direction of home, and then something about the way he'd been acting made you look back. He was getting into his car, and there was a woman in it.
But there wasn't.
A real doll, blonde and foxy. Young, maybe 22 or so, and really sexy. Sitting up front, right next to the driver's seat.
I can't say a thing like that, Susan exclaimed.
Of course you can. You can say anything you want to. You're the last one who saw him, aren't you? Who else is going to know who was in that car? You're the one who saw him get into it and drive away.
But why? Susan asked.
Why make up something like that? What good will it do?
It'll lead them away from us. Right now, who do they have to suspect of having a hand in this? Students. Maybe not us exactly, but students in general. Who else did Mr. G have in his life? And when they start going over the students in his classes, they're going to zero in on a few people who've had some bad problems with him. That means me, and maybe Jeff. And once they hit on us, it'll follow pretty quick that the rest of you get nailed too. So what do? We throw in a girlfriend, and right away there's a whole new look to things. There's a secret part of Mr. G's life that nobody knows about. Who is this woman? Where did she come from? How come they were driving off together? Who's going to think about students when there's a sex scandal to worry over?
I can't do that, Mark, Susan said shakily. Mr. Griffin was married, you know. How would his wife feel, hearing something like that? She'd think
he ran out on her. What's so bad about that? It's a kindness, baby. If she loved the guy, then it's hard to believe anyone could. Wouldn't she rather think of him off having a good time someplace, even if he wasn't with her, than dead?
Well, when you put it like that...
You'd better get moving. We've been standing here talking 5 minutes, and they're down there at the office waiting for you.
Mark, come with me, Susan said pleadingly. I just can't do it by myself. We could say you were with me after school, that you waited for me till the conference was over, that you and I both saw the woman in the car.
No way. Mark said firmly. You're Miss Innocence. Stick me in the picture and we've lost the ball game. You can do it, Sue. You'll do just great.
I'm scared.
Don't be. It'll be simple as pie. A girl like you, who's going to doubt her? Now, on with the show, babe. And remember, I'm counting on you.
He laid his hand briefly on her shoulder.
I'll try.
Susan drew in a long breath.
And after school?
You go on home like you would on any other day. This is your part now. When you've carried this through, it's over. The rest of us will take care of the other part, the bit in the mountains and moving the car and whatever. Okay?
Okay, Susan said. If you say so, Mark.
She took a few steps down the hall and stopped abruptly as he said,
Sue?
What?
Relax, will you? Don't walk in there looking like you're facing a firing squad. Remember, you don't know a thing about why they're calling you in. It might be for something great, like telling you you're going to be named Student of the Year.
He stood quietly watching with narrowed eyes as she continued down the hall to the office door. She paused and looked back at him. He raised his hand in a small, encouraging wave. Susan opened the door and went inside.
Christ, Mark said softly under his breath.
He bent over the fountain and took a drink.